As the Lincoln Park Zoo takes a look back at 150 years of history, employees like Adrian Horrigan are also looking at ways the zoo can continue to grow.
There are so many challenges facing wildlife and our natural environments right now, and everything we can do to provide a space for wildlife in our urbanizing world is central to our mission.
Plus, there's a new exhibit at the Spertus Institute in Chicago featuring the work of early 20th century Jewish artist Todros Geller. While he wasn't religious, explains curator Susan Weininger, you sense these values in his art.
There's something in Judaism called tikkun olam. It means repair of the world. His Judaism expressed itself as a kind of effort to make social justice, to make things better. And we see examples of that in some of his work.
But first, President Obama is back in Illinois, and coming to Urbana tomorrow, we find out more about his visit. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, we're visiting two cultural institutions in Chicago. I bet you've been to one, the other maybe not. We're going to be at the Lincoln Park Zoo to hear how much the mission has changed in 150 years and hear how an influential Jewish artist whose work 100 years ago is being remembered today. But first, President Obama is coming to Central Illinois. Tomorrow, the president's going to be visiting the University of Illinois campus. President Obama will be accepting the 2018 Paul H. Douglas Award for Ethics in Government from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs and delivering a talk at 11 a.m. from the campus. Interest in this visit is so widespread that more than 22,000 students tried to get tickets for the event. It is ticketed, not open to the public. Just about 1,200 or so have been given out. And if you're not among those lucky few to be there, our 21st team is going to be doing special broadcast coverage. If you tune in tomorrow at 11 a.m., tune into 21stshow.org, and you can hear all of our coverage. Joining us now to give us a preview of this visit and this kind of crazy week in Illinois politics is Mark Maxwell. He's WCIA3's Capitol Bureau Chief. WGLT's Ryan Denham is also on the line from Bloomington Normal. Mark, Ryan, welcome back to the 21st. Guys, thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla. Glad to be here.
Thanks.
Mark, let me start with you. First, regarding President Obama's visit, I'm thinking that his last big trip downstate was actually to your neck of the woods, to the State House, when he addressed a joint session in Springfield. Am I right on that?
That's right. In 2016, toward the end of his second term, he came back to where it all began, the State House, where he was once a state senator, and talked with everyone. Many of the politicians, really in both parties, lavished him with praise. He joked back and forth and sort of took a bit of a friendly jab at Springfield's favorite food, the horseshoe sandwich. And people were shocked and dismayed at how could the favorite son of Illinois politics not like the favorite food of Springfield.
Right.
But it was his return, and really he was able to remind everybody that his start as a state senator in Springfield those many years ago focused on ethics and government. In fact, he was one to require more transparency and more reporting of campaign contributions, and to limit gifts to public officials. And so that was really a springboard for his early days climbing the political ladder, was calling for more transparency and better ethics in government. So it's a bit fitting that his next return back to Illinois, the University of Illinois this time, is to receive an award for ethics.
Mark, I wonder how much interest do you think the President Obama, still generates here in Illinois? 2 years ago, he was still in office. A lot has happened since then. What are your thoughts?
That's such a tricky question, right? It's an interesting question because Illinois is, of course, his home state, and it depends on who you talk to, which circles. If we look at 2016, this area, Central Illinois, generally voted strong for candidate, now President Trump, and of course, candidate Trump presented himself to the public as the antithesis of everything Obama, the anti-Obama, really. And that worked for him. But on college campuses and in many Springfield circles, in Democratic circles, the president probably couldn't be more popular. Here we are in 2018. And is middle America, the independent voter, yearning more for a return to a less conflicted, less under investigation president, right? And that's perhaps what we will find out. President Obama very much in his legacy building phase as he looks to reach out to younger people. So I think we'll see and hear from him tomorrow how he wants to frame that conversation, but it certainly seems that he's starting to reach back out to people these 2 years after he's been out of office.
Ryan, I wonder what if this event is going to be, as Mark said, on campus. It's for students primarily. Is this generating buzz, for example, in the Bloomington-Normal area?
It doesn't appear so. I think there was, truthfully, a bit more buzz among local Democrats for the scuttled Joe Biden appearance in Springfield at a Democratic Party event. He was scheduled to be there and had to cancel. And, you know, with that event, there was going to be a lot of local Democrats making the trip down there, and there was a lot of excitement over that. I think because it is a more of a student event here at U of I, there's kind of a lot less interest in it in that sense. And, you know, and keep in mind, too, that Obama was, you know, obviously popular among Democrats here in McLean County, where I work here in Bloomington Normal. But Obama only won the county in 2008 by less than 1,000 votes, and he lost to Romney here in 2012. So you're not exactly a favorite son in that respect here in McLean County.
Right. And when we think about the topic, Mark, I did want to – you mentioned about what President Obama will be speaking on. He's getting an award for ethics. I'm thinking about the statements he made about John McCain and his ethics as a politician at his eulogy over the past weekend. I imagine you think we might be hearing more from President Obama in this vein?
Yes, and he and others, George W. Bush as well, have really shied away from taking personal direct shots, but you don't have to pay very close attention to recognize that there, many of their public statements are shaped and construed to be criticisms of the current president, President Trump. So I do expect that we will hear more of that, specifically talking about ethics. I mean, you've got a president right now who, I mean, has very open conflicts of interest with, you know, hosting and wining and dining officials at his private golf estates. I mean, there's a lot of this donor access that President Trump promised to drain the swamp, and yet members of his administration have been forced to resign or been under scrutiny, like the head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt. So I do think that and that's something that resonates here in Central Illinois very much. This part of the state, and really the whole state, doesn't have much of a taste for those who would use positions of power to their advantage. And I think that we'll probably hear the president speak in that lane to some extent.
Mark, to that point, I wanted to pivot to some other political news that's going on, and I'm thinking particularly of the confirmation hearings that are happening in Washington this week for Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Senator Dick Durbin, Illinois' senior senator, has been a big part of these hearings, and this is just to your point about this. This is Senator Durbin has been very insistent on a confrontation over an exchange that he had with Brett Kavanaugh in 2006. And just yesterday, he had a chance to question him. I wanted to play just a little bit of that exchange.
I asked you about this when we had a meeting in my office.
Yes.
And I still don't understand your answer. You were involved in the discussions about access to counsel for detainees. You confirmed this during the meeting we had in my office, and there are multiple media reports as well. You were involved in discussions regarding detained U.S. combatants. You were involved, and this is one I want to be specific about, you were involved with President Bush's 2005 signing statement on Senator John McCain's amendment banning cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment of detainees. There were no exceptions in your answer given to me in 2006. So if those three, based on the limited documents which we've been given, are obvious, what were you trying to tell me here? Did you really disclose accurately your role?
Yes, I understood the question then and my answer then, and I understood. I understood the question then and the answer then, and I understand the question now and the answer now. You were concerned about whether I was involved in the program two other nominees had been involved in, and the report that Senator Feinstein produced, they showed that I wasn't. In other words, the program, crafting the program for the enhanced interrogation techniques for the detainees.
Mr. Judge Kavanaugh, that's not the question. Do you see me asking you whether you crafted the program? I didn't. I asked you about your involvement in the Haynes judgment, and then you went further. You violated the second rule I give to every witness. You answered more than I asked.
That's a lengthy exchange. It's just part of half an hour of back and forth between Senator Dick Durbin and Brett Kavanaugh. Mark Maxwell, I wanted to play that whole exchange so people get a little sense of what's been going on in Washington. This is a really complicated issue that Senator Durbin was getting into with potential Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
It really does. It speaks to a campaign promise that President Trump, or then-candidate Trump, made that we're going to bring back torture and waterboarding at Guantanamo Bay and other types of torture. And this goes back to a very ugly time in American history. Just to set the table, Brett Kavanaugh first appears on the scene in this story as a lawyer for the Bush White House. And he's advising the Bush White House on which of these proposals, which of these actions, these executive actions they are signing off on through the Department of Defense at Guantanamo Bay, which of them would be risky constitutionally. In fact, he says, I think Justice Kennedy, who he's now been nominated to replace and who he formerly clerked for, he had a personal relationship with Justice Anthony Kennedy. Kavanaugh tells the White House, I think what we're doing now will never pass his judicial scrutiny. Now, why would someone give that advice to the White House? Presumably to help them button up their approach and steer around that constitutional hurdle. Now, we don't know all of that. We can only presume. But I think what Senator Durbin was really driving at there was, did he give misleading testimony? At the end of all of that exchange you just played, Judge Kavanaugh said, quote, I can't recall what I said. He also recently said, quote, I do not believe the analysis in that torture memo was correct. So he's sort of trying to say, I think torture is bad, but I can't recall what I said at the time. And so Senator Durbin is really driving at, one, were you misleading the public? But two, were you just a vassal of power? Were you a political tool and instrument when you worked for the Bush White House? And I think that's really what is undergirding Senator Durbin's line of questioning there.
We're talking politics with WCIA Capitol Bureau Chief Mark Maxwell and WGLT's Ryan Denham. Ryan, getting back to President Obama and to this question about our presidents, whether we're talking about President Trump now, President Obama before, I know that there are some folks who were very nostalgic thinking about President Obama's roots here in Illinois. And I wonder if that begs the question about the Democratic Party here. Are there any future Obamas, any future Democratic stars in Illinois that we need to be keeping our eyes on?
Well, it's tough to say that there's going to be another Obama-like political character. I think he was such a unique person in that respect. But obviously there are several sort of up-and-coming Democratic quote-unquote stars who might make a statewide play or beyond. I think, Sherry Bustos is sort of the logical choice there. She's a congressman out of Western Illinois, and she's even played a hand here in McLean County and Bloomington Normal in some of our local races. So was here for a fundraiser, recruited some candidates. I think Daniel Biss, the former Democratic gubernatorial candidate who lost to J.B. Pritzker, certainly, we'd expect to see him come up again in another race. He actually won McLean County in the primary, but lost in just about every other county in Illinois. I think Susana Mendoza will be another one to keep an eye on. Right now, already a statewide office holder, only 46 years old, has certainly come into her own as a sort of a foil for Governor Rauner.
And her name is now being floated, right? Yeah, her name's now being floated, Ryan, as a possible Chicago mayoral race contender. Now that the other news of the week, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel says he's not running for reelection. I do think it's always an interesting question about the direction of the Democratic Party. And I wonder, as we're thinking about this, as we're seeing all of these races across the country and the push and pull between the far, I guess, the moderate and the far left of the Democratic Party, are there any few races that point to this tension as well in the Bloomington-Normal area?
Well, I think we have a pretty interesting county clerk race here in McLean County, and I know it's a hard thing to believe that a county clerk race would be interesting, but it sort of has become one. We have a Republican incumbent here, Kathy Michael, seeking her third term, and Democrats are actually running someone against her, a woman named Nikita Richards. And it's become very much a proxy fight between all of these energized local Democrats and sort of the establishment Republican Party here in our county that is used to winning. You know, they've got all the countywide seats. They've got all the state house districts. They've got all that locked up. And now Democrats sense that this might be an opening, and they're sort of making this county clerk their number one target in the county. And it certainly has revealed a lot about the Democratic Party and how much energy they have right now. They're being a lot more aggressive with some of their plays and the way they're messaging and, you know, challenging signatures and doing all these kind of things you wouldn't see a few years ago. So I think that's sort of a harbinger of where the party might be going here.
And, Mark, I imagine perhaps we're going to see President Obama taking a more active role in some campaigns across Illinois.
In fact, he's already started doing that. Just, I believe, 2 or 3 weeks ago, he released a new campaign video. The first of his many video endorsements likely to come out went to Democrat J.B. Pritzker. And he's been very clear about that, I believe, as has former senator as well, but Vice President Joe Biden. They've said things like, you can bet we'll be involved in 2018 because they want to play an active role in reshaping and re-energizing their party that has seen losses on Capitol Hill and the White House. The judiciary is being reshaped in a more conservative fashion. So, yeah, they're very much looking at how they can try to thread the needle and bring back victories for their party.
That's WCIA's Capitol Bureau Chief Mark Maxwell. I want to thank Ryan Denham for being with us as well from WGLT. And reminder, if you tune into 21stShow.org tomorrow at 11 a.m., we'll have special coverage of President Obama's speech at the University of Illinois. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Support for the 21st comes from the University of Illinois Press, publishers of An Illini Place, Building the University of Illinois Campus, documenting the grand plans and intimate stories behind the creation of a classic American campus. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years of publishing.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This weekend, the Spertus Institute in Chicago debuts a new exhibit of work by an artist who was central to the history of modern American Jewish art. It's called Todros Geller, Strange Worlds. Todros Geller was born in the Ukraine and immigrated to Chicago in 1918. And it's the collision of those two strange worlds, the old country and the new, the sacred and the secular, that he brought to life in a range of media, many of which are on display at the Spertus. According to the museum, he was fondly referred to as the Dean of Chicago Jewish Artists. But it begs the question, what is Jewish art? Is it simply work made by Jewish artists? Is it the work that deals in Jewish themes? As Susan Weininger explained to me when I spoke to her at the Spertus Institute earlier this week, it's not just art made by people who are Jewish. It's art that reflects Jewish religious themes, Jewish culture, or Jewish life. She's a Roosevelt University Professor Emerita of Art History and the co-curator of the show. I also spoke with Yonit Behar, Spertus Institute's curator of collections, and I began by asking Yonit about the exhibit title, Strange Worlds.
So that title comes from an artwork that's titled Strange Worlds, and we thought it was a perfect way to title this exhibition and as a sort of summary for Geller's whole practice. It's pointing to Geller being an immigrant from Ukraine who arrived to Chicago from his way to Montreal in the early 20th century, more specifically 1918 to Chicago. And he was sort of bringing that Ukrainian culture and past with him from a very small town, very traditional Jewish background, and arriving to Chicago to this new modern city. So the strange worlds, it's that contradictory and juxtapositions between the old and new world.
And when he arrived in Chicago, I wonder what Chicago was like in 1918 for Jewish immigrants.
Chicago was, I think, a place where he found a home. There were over 100,000 people in Chicago who spoke Yiddish. There were other communities of immigrants. And when he arrived, he settled on the west side of Chicago in a Jewish community where there was a Jewish community center called the Jewish People's Institute, which had art classes. He immediately began to teach in those classes while he was still a student at the Art Institute of Chicago, because he had had some training prior to that. So for him, it was, I think, a welcoming place.
And what kind of art do you have on display here? There's a lot of it's he worked in a variety of media.
We're showing, which I think it's an example, samples of what Geller did. So paintings, lithographs, prints. He made also stained glass for a number of places in Chicago, and we're reproducing those here on the glass of our gallery here at Spurtis.
He illustrated books, and he even did some things that we aren't showing here. He did comic books. He was very, very versatile.
And so when you write, when you walk in, one of the first things you see is a painting of Chicago.
The first work you see is a painting that is titled Michigan Avenue Bridge. And it's together with a number of other works that represent urban and industrial scenes. So we see Chicago, and in the background we see industries and workers. We see landscapes with snow and workers working in the snow. And some of these works were done for the WBA, and maybe Susan can talk a little bit more about that.
In the 30s, Geller was employed, as so many artists were at the time, in the government-sponsored art projects. He was employed as a printmaker primarily, and the prints that we see are very much a part of what was typical of WPA work, industrial scenes, scenes of labor, and artists at this time thought of themselves as laborers. Often their work was intended to make change. It was a time when artists really felt that art could make a difference, and they identified themselves with workers, so that we see in some of these images people who are working under great duress, but these are very, very fine. He was technically very, he had great virtuosity technically.
Maybe we can look at those a little closer. So he also had an idea of, when you say change, you mean social change.
Yes. This also overlaps with the traditional Jewish background. He was not a religious person in a ritual sense. I don't think he probably was very observant or went to synagogue very often, but he transformed Jewish values. There is something in Judaism called tikkun olam. It means repair of the world. So that his Judaism expressed itself as a kind of effort to make social justice, to make things better in the world. And we see examples of that in some of his work as well.
Well, and it's interesting when you're looking at these pictures, it almost brings to mind, it looks like photos of Chicago's industrial age. It brings to mind for me things like the jungle and writings that maybe would have been contemporary of that time.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think there are a couple of things going on. First of all, these are very progressive artistically. They look, they have a quality of glorifying the industrial city. At the same time, we see in some of them the difficulty of this kind of labor, industrial labor. So I think we see two things going on at the same time.
And so part of, you mentioned the, going back to the exhibition's title of Strange Worlds, is this straddling of different worlds, his worlds as an immigrant, his identity as a Jewish artist. What does it mean when we say Jewish art?
I don't know if I can answer that question. I've thought a lot about it. I think that I would say Jewish art maybe is art by a Jewish person. So there's really has nothing, things don't have to have anything in common with one another. On the other hand, there is Jewish art that was made by people who weren't Jewish. I mean, I could probably, there are a lot of ritual objects that are made by non-Jewish people that you would have to say are Jewish. So it's not a question I can answer. You need?
But I think maybe just to add in relationship to Geller, that he was interested in this exact same idea, what is Jewish art? And he asked that all along his career. He wanted to have a Jewish museum, but what does that mean, right? Who would be included? What kind of art would we have? So we will have documents in the exhibition from the Spurtus archives that necessarily point to these kind of complicated question and answers.
And in terms of his work culturally, I wonder what motifs you see in his work that you think are expressions of Jewish culture or life.
Well, we have in the exhibit, we have a portfolio called Yiddish Motifs, which are typical scenes of Jewish life and Jewish folk tales and so forth. We have in the exhibit this wonderful Hasidic dance that shows a couple, a newly married couple, dancing with holding two edges of a handkerchief because they can't hold hands according to Jewish law in public, but it's done in a very avant-garde style, so that Geller was combining his understanding of modernist art movements with this very traditional subject. Geller did live through World War II, and he made a series of works in response to the Holocaust, and he called them the Yellow Badge series. And we do have one, we have two crucifixions in the show, one done way before the Nazis came to power, and one done after the Holocaust. And the one that was done after the Holocaust, you can see right on the cross, there's a yellow strip of fabric with a Jewish star on it, so that he was responding to that particular tragedy in a number of ways, and he often connected it to the martyrs, Jewish martyrs of the past. And we will have some examples of that from the stained glass windows that we're going to reproduce as well.
And what did Chicago art look like during his time period in the 20s and 30s? Was it very avant-garde?
There were a group of progressive artists with whom Geller was associated who were exploring modernist techniques. But there was a very, very strong conservative movement in Chicago that continued right through the 1930s and even into the 40s.
And I know this is always difficult, but there does seem to be a very particular style to his art. I wonder how you would describe it. Yonit?
I would say there's a lot of movement or an intention to show movement, especially in the work that Susan was referring to with the dance. So it's a very kind of traditional theme that's being represented, but in the background and in the foreground, there's these kind of lines that show the movement of the dance. So I would think that was new at the time to kind of try to show that in the works.
I think that there were a variety of modernist movements that emerged in the early part of the 20th century, and I think a lot of artists tried on many of them, or try to even combine some of them. But mostly what we see is a little bit of abstraction, a willingness to distort things, and I think that Geller tried a lot of different kinds of techniques in these industrial scenes. It comes close to something called precisionism, which was an American kind of a kind of subcategory of cubism that was particularly American and dealt with the modern city, and we see a lot of that in in some cases we see this big action that Yonit was referring to, which may connect to the style called futurism. So that, and then we see in these southwestern images this beautiful color that emerges. So he's also experimenting with some abstract use of color as well.
And just to add one more thing, there are also some works in the exhibition that resemble Chagall and sort of his style, like the Stadel scene and the crucifixion, for example. Those are some works that I would say have a similar style that are perhaps dreamlike, I would describe them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What influence did Geller have on other artists, young artists in Chicago and throughout the U.S.? Suzanne?
Geller was a teacher for most of his life, and he taught at the precursor of Spertus, which was called the College of Jewish Studies. He taught art classes there. He also worked with some African-American artists, which was typical of Jewish artists. A lot of them taught at the Abraham Lincoln Center, which was the community center that African-American artists went to take classes.
He taught at the Hull House for some time with other African-American artists, and that population was an immigrant population. So I think he really believed in the role of art for that section of the population.
And when you say that he really believed in the role of art, what do you think he thought the role of art was?
It could have meant many things. But because, and in the exhibition we tried to do this as well, as sort of show Geller's representations of different sections of the society at the time. Like Susan was saying, the Southwest scenes, which represent, you know, the New Mexico African-American population as well. This sort of him as a Jewish artist also looking at other groups, other people, and sort of blurring these distinctions of what a Jewish artist can paint or what can represent. Who can he teach, right? It was, I think, very open to blurring those boundaries.
And also maybe also with other people who were maybe more on the margins of society as well, it sounds like?
Yes, exactly.
That's Yonit Bahar of the Spertus Institute, along with Susan Weininger, speaking to me during a recent visit to their new exhibition of work by the prominent Chicago Jewish artist Todros Geller. It's called Strange Worlds. It will be up through the new year. We'll have more information at our website, 21stshow.org. Coming up after the break, we're going to be visiting Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo and hear what they're doing to celebrate their 150th anniversary. Stay tuned to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We'll have that conversation just after the break.
Support for the 21st comes from Cranard Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Limbs, a premiere performance by Chicago-based artist Erica Gressman, September 13th at 7:30 p.m. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you've ever been to Chicago in the summer, you've probably strolled through the Lincoln Park Zoo on the city's northeast side. 150 years ago, back in the summer of 1868, commissioners of New York Central Park sent Chicago a gift of two swans. That officially gave the zoo its start. That makes it one of the oldest zoos in the U.S. and one of the only ones that's remained free since its inception. We sat down with Adrienne Horrigan at Lincoln Park Zoo earlier this week. She's one of the curators of the exhibit From Swans to Science, 150 Years of the Lincoln Park Zoo. Outside of the Lion House and across from the Swan Pond, the cicadas were in full force when I started by asking Adrienne about how the zoo began back in 1868.
The gift was set up by two brothers, one of whom lived in New York and was a very prominent founder of a lot of cultural institutions there. His name is Andrew H. Green. And his brother, Oliver B. Green, was living here in Chicago working on the Illinois-Michigan Canal. He knew about the swans in Central Park and how popular they were and wanted to bring some of them to Chicago.
And how did the swans do?
They did great, actually. There were two pairs of swans that came originally. They multiplied, and their offspring lived here for generations.
Are there still existing offspring of those swans here today?
Actually, no. We have a different species of swans here today, which is an interesting story and sort of comes full circle on the zoo's mission. The original swans that we had were European swans, mute swans. The swans that we have here now and have had for decades are trumpeter swans, which are endemic to Illinois. They are from here. They're from the upper Midwest. However, about 100 years ago, they were almost extinct due to habitat loss and hunting. And for decades, Lincoln Park Zoo has been part of a program to rebuild those populations in the wild. And actually, our zoo swans here have hatched and raised dozens of chicks, of cygnets, baby swans, and over 40 of them have been reintroduced to the wild. And we actually had one of the swans that was born here at Lincoln Park Zoo released to the wild, become one of the first wild swans to nest in Illinois in over 100 years.
Wow. And I think that does speak to the mission of the zoo and how zoos have changed over the past century. When the zoo was first opened, how many other animals were there within the first 5 years?
After the swans, they sort of started trickling in. People would donate animals. So by the early 1870s, there were a couple dozen species and probably under 100 animals, but quite a few were here, mainly native animals, native to the area. And then as we get closer to 1900, the 1880s and 1890s, larger animals and more exotic species started getting added.
And at that point, was the zoo really a place for people to come and see animals that they wouldn't have normally seen? Or you mentioned a lot, some of them were still native to Illinois.
Sure. Early on, it was a lot of native wildlife, but within the first couple decades, it became a place where people really did come to see wildlife. And a lot of people in Chicago, it was a rapidly growing city. There was not as much green space as people might like. So this was a real refuge for people from early on, that we had this wonderful green space where people could get out of their urban environment and see wildlife. Some of them local, some of it exotic, but really things that people were not seeing in their day-to-day life.
Like what kind of animals?
Early on, there were big cats and beavers and prairie dogs, eagles. Later on, lions, tigers, sea lions. The seal pool that you see today, the original version of that was actually constructed in 1879.
Wow. And the seals, it's a very hot day today. And I did notice the seals seem to be really enjoying the water. How do you all handle the temperature changes in Chicago are pretty extreme. And I always wonder, when it's a day like today, where it's almost 100 degrees, how the polar bear's doing, whereas in the winter, maybe he's okay?
Sure. Actually, all the animals have choice. So we provide appropriate climates to them, and they have the option whether or not on a hot day like today, the polar bears could be swimming in their pool, they can be inside in air conditioning, or if they choose to, they could be outside. And when we look at what animals are going to come to the zoo and live here, we take a lot of things into account, conservation status and also the climate here and how they will do. So we, you know, if you see our new snow monkey exhibit, that is the primate that lives in the coldest climates outside of humans. So the Chicago weather really does well for them.
You mentioned primates. That's one of the older groups of animals that you've had here, particularly when you think about gorillas, right?
Mm-hmm. One of the most famous zoo animals was Bushman the gorilla, who was here in the mid-century, in the mid of the last century.
And are some of his descendants still here?
In the mid-1970s, we built a very revolutionary exhibit at the time, the old Lester Fisher Great Ape House, which had animals living in family groups, which was a really wonderful new way, not new way, but naturalistic way to hold animals. And from that point on, we have had more and more births at the zoo.
How would you say the zoo's mission has changed? When do you think it started changing? You mentioned in the 70s, the idea of shifting more towards conservation versus entertainment.
Absolutely. This has always been a wonderful place to take your family. It's been free to the public for 150 years. But as you said, our mission has evolved just like humans' relationship with the wild has evolved. And in the early 1960s, when Lester Fisher took over as director of the zoo, he was the first veterinarian to be zoo director. And he really focused on natural behaviors, animal welfare, in a scientific way, and sort of put us on this path to a more scientific approach to providing the very best care we can for animals. That started in 1962 when we started building new exhibits that promoted natural behaviors and gave them a really natural space. In 1989, we launched our conservation and science program with a single scientist. Today, we have over 40 scientists working at the zoo and abroad, working with both wild and zoo populations for conservation work.
And what kind of conservation work do you think the zoo, as you said, there's a lot of different scientists you have working both here and abroad. Where would you say the focus is now when you're thinking about conservation work and the science at the Lincoln Park Zoo?
What we are really trying to do is to inspire people to create environments where humans and wildlife can thrive in a rapidly urbanizing world. And we take a lot of different approaches to doing that. We have endocrinologists who are studying hormones. We have people working with wild chimp populations in the field in Africa. We have an urban wildlife center here that has actually gone national that looks at the urban wildlife populations in Chicago and throughout the country.
And you mentioned one thing about the zoo. It's always been free. Has it always been part of the Chicago Parks Department?
Actually, it was part of the Chicago Park District until the mid-90s, and we are actually now run by a nonprofit organization, the Lincoln Park Zoological Society. And we are the only free public zoo that is run by a private foundation.
And why is that important to the zoo's mission? I know certainly for people in Chicago, lots of people even with kids, the fact that the zoo is free and open makes it a really easy place to visit when there are a lot of other things that are pretty expensive to take children to in the city.
Absolutely. And to provide that opportunity for everyone who's in Chicago, near Chicago, visiting Chicago, to be able to take their family here and have an experience with wildlife and participate in some of our wonderful learning programs. It's really important for us to remain free to be able to develop those bonds between people and wildlife.
As you think about these 150 years and the challenges that are ahead for you all, do you think they're mostly financial, or are they in the science and the conservation area as you've talked about things like how we balance urban environments with wildlife and maintaining those populations?
Sure. I'm sure, as you know, and the people listening know, there are so many challenges facing wildlife and our natural environments right now. And everything we can do to provide a space for wildlife in our urbanizing world is central to our mission. And also, as you mentioned, we're a free institution, and we really do rely on our members and donors and the multitude of supporters that we have to continue that mission.
We're hanging out right now. Where are we in front of? We're inside the mammal house?
We are in the Regenstein Small Mammal and Reptile House right now in front of the nocturnal exhibits.
You all have some special, you have a couple exhibitions that are going on right now throughout
yes,
the zoo?
Yes, we do. It takes the form of a walking tour, so it's a great thing to incorporate into your regular visit to the zoo with the family. You can stop into the Kovler Lion House, which, as I mentioned earlier, is a historic landmark building, and pick up an exhibition pass. It has a little map in there with 10 exhibition stops. You can go around to each of those, find out a little bit of the past, present, future of the zoo. Some of them, like the one here in Small Mammal Reptile House, have some artifacts as well. We have a video of Zoo Parade from the 1950s playing. And at each of these stops, there's a secret code word. If you fill in the whole sentence and drop off your completed ballot, then you get entered in a really cool prize drawing from Wendella.
And what is the Zoo Parade?
Yes, Zoo Parade is a television show that aired here in Chicago in the 1950s. It was hosted by Marlon Perkins, who was then director of Lincoln Park Zoo. After leaving Lincoln Park Zoo, he went on to St. Louis Zoo, where he became even more famous for hosting Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. But Zoo Parade was filmed right here at Lincoln Park Zoo, and it was really the precursor to all those nature programs you see on TV today. And as the 1950s, people were first getting televisions in the home as a common thing, and this was really the first time when wildlife was coming into the home and people were sitting around the television watching it.
The makers of Kenner Ration and Kenner Biscuit, America's super dog foods, present television's original Zoo Parade. Brought to you direct from the world-famous Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago.
There's one that I don't think very many people are going to have any trouble with, those that have ever seen a wood duck, but let's just take a quick look at a wood duck and see what he looks like. What would you say, Mr.?
So that started right here in Chicago.
Yes, right in, actually, in the basement of Park Place, which is now our food court. At the time was our small mammal and reptile house.
And you mentioned the Kovler Lion House. Now, that's the original building for the zoo. It was built in 1912?
That's one of the oldest buildings here. Yes, actually, our birdhouse is older than that. That was constructed in 1904 as the birdhouse, and Lion House has been there since 1912.
The Lion House is about to be renovated?
Exactly. We've had several renovations of it over the years as we learn more about animal care and how to better design exhibits for animal welfare. And so now we're in the planning phases of the next iteration of Lion House. We're going to keep its beautiful historical details, but really improve on its animal spaces, and we're excited about that.
And when you think about the buildings at the zoo, I wonder how tough it is to balance the historic preservation of some of these beautiful buildings like the Lion House from 1912 with the needs of a modern zoo.
Exactly. And that's one thing we've seen with Lion House over the years. When it was first constructed, it had many more exhibits in it than it does today, because there were what was sort of referred to as postage stamp collections, when people thought the best zoo and the best way to educate people and get them in touch with wildlife is to provide as much variety as you can, and so have as many animals as you can. And now we're really looking at what is the best space for these animals, how do these animals thrive, how do we create an environment where they have the best welfare possible.
Adrian, as people can hear, the kids in the background, of course, that's everyone loves to bring small kids to the zoo.
Absolutely.
What are you hoping that no matter what age they are, from 2 to 18 or even older, what they will take away from being here?
I think whatever age you are, when you actually come face to face with wildlife and have some sort of an interaction with them, watch them, you know, engaging with their enrichment or in a training session or playing in their enclosure, it creates a bond that you don't get necessarily otherwise. And hopefully you take that home with you and you think about their wild environments and how do we preserve those and how do we keep the earth a place where these animals can flourish.
Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back. That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.